Case number 13-3071, United States of America versus Charles Ike Emore, also known as Ike Emanoha, also known as Charles Ikeson. Mr. Quinn for the appellant, Mr. Faruqi for the appellee.
May it please the court, and good morning. My name is John Quinn. I'm here on behalf of Sunrise Academy, the appellant in this case. For more than 10 years, Sunrise Academy has educated up to 150 educationally challenged students per year. These were some of the most difficult students in the District of Columbia public school system, with severe learning disabilities, often from troubled homes with troubled backgrounds. In fact, they couldn't attend DC public schools. They had to go to private schools. Nevertheless, many of them earned high school degrees meeting DCPS standards at Sunrise over 10 years. Sunrise had more than 60 teachers, many of whom chose to come to Sunrise from public schools in Maryland and Virginia. Today, Sunrise still operates programs in Fairfax County Public Schools, Arlington County Public Schools, and in the District of Columbia, including DCPS schools. Sunrise's management has changed. Mr. Emore is no longer there. The board's changed. No one connected with Mr. Emore's alleged scheme here has anything to do with Sunrise now.
The key time is the status of Sunrise at the time the crimes were committed. The key time is what the status of Sunrise was at the time the crimes were committed. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Not the current board composition.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that.
All right. And I think it's undisputed that a defendant can't file a proceeding like you have in a forfeiture case, correct? It has to be a third party. The defendant can't come in and contest.
That's correct.
And the district court found that Sunrise, at least at the time of the offenses, was the alter ego of Mr. Emore.
Yes.
Where in your petition do you dispute alter ego status?
Well, what we
or
say
did you not have to there?
Yes, thank you. What we say in the petition is that if we accept the alter ego finding as true, then there was no transfer at all, and therefore.
So you do not contest the alter ego determination in your petition?
No, not at all, Your Honor. We plead the case alternatively.
Okay, so where in your, can you just point me in your petition to which page in the JA you contest alter ego status?
We contest alter ego. I see the one citation that I referenced. In other words, that we alleged that if there was an alter ego status here, then the transfers could not have been fraudulent and there could have been no transfer at all. In addition to that, we accepted under one alternative set of pleading of allegations, we accepted the allegations that Mr. Emore defrauded Sunrise in the PFO is true. Okay? If those allegations are true, then Mr. Emore could not have been Sunrise's alter ego as a matter of law.
I'll ask one more time. Can you show me where you contested that you were the alter ego factually? As opposed to saying, if the alter ego, then there wasn't a crime.
Well, I don't know that we use those words, Your Honor. However,
Don't have to be those magic words. It's just, it seems to me that you had to show that you're not the defendant to be able to bring this proceeding. And to do that, given what the district court had previously found in the preliminary order, you had to show that you had to at least allege facts that you were not the alter ego at the time of the offense.
First of all, Your Honor, I don't believe there is any such pleading requirement under 853 at all. I don't think there's ever a negative pleading requirement. This is notice pleading, first of all, and it doesn't require a statement that you're not an alter ego, but particularly in this case, it doesn't, because the law of the case is that Mr. Emore defrauded Sunrise. If Mr. Emore defrauded Sunrise, he could not have been the alter ego. So we challenge it another way.
Did you disagree with the legal test that the court applied for alter ego, or do you disagree with the factual predicate, or both?
We disagree with both.
Okay, and what is your disagreement first with just the legal test that the district court applied?
The legal test?
In finding alter ego.
Well, there's a reverse piercing theory that was applied. First of all, we Sunrise had no opportunity to participate in this hearing. We didn't get an opportunity to present any evidence at all.
Well, there were seven witnesses from Sunrise at the hearing, so what evidence would you put on that wasn't already put on through the seven Sunrise witnesses and all the other documents about Sunrise's finances, separate minute, the operations of the board, minute keeping? What evidence would you put on?
Sunrise didn't put on any of that evidence.
What evidence would you put on?
Well, yeah, we'd bring other board members. We have 60 teachers who would come in that would talk about the procedures and how Sunrise functioned as an entity, how its board of directors managed the company. It was a very structured and organized. This was a big company. It had accountants. It had several layers of management. The evidence, the alter ego evidence in this case was, we thought, not particularly strong, but it was delivered by witnesses that were not presented by Sunrise Academy. We have, at least a due process right in this case to show that we were not the alter ego.
But I would disagree strongly that the alter ego evidence wasn't strong. You had uncontested evidence that they were, putting money in his commissary account while he was in prison. But let's put that aside for a moment. The district court's order denying your petition stated that it was not relying upon the alter ego determination.
Yes.
So what difference does it make then to us whether or not you could participate in that determination at all?
I agree. The district court did not rely on that grounds to dismiss the complaint. So, Sunrise believes that if the law of the case is applied, and it's an issue of law, that Mr. Emor could not have been the alter ego of Sunrise. And that the reason for that is that he's basically was pled guilty to defrauding Sunrise, and that's the law of the case. So if that's the law of the case...
Where is that law of the case? Because when I looked at the plea of the transcript, mm-hmm. It was very much an unresolved question who the victim of this fraud was.
Well,
so can you point me to where explicitly the government agrees that he pled to defrauding Sunrise as the victim of this crime?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. Joint Appendix page 205, Mr. Emor pled guilty to, quote, obtaining money from Sunrise for his benefit.
Right, but that begs the question of whether the problem is that he was obtaining money from Sunrise, i.e. Sunrise is a victim, or Sunrise was a funnel for him obtaining money that was actually coming from DCPS. That doesn't answer the question of who the victim is. DCPS is a focus in that sentence on he obtained money via Sunrise or that he took money from Sunrise. So that's completely ambiguous to me as to that emphasis.
Well,
am I wrong? Tell me how I'm wrong.
Again, there are many legal arguments that we make about that as well. The money was Sunrise's money. These were firm fixed price contracts between Sunrise and DCPS. Under the law, and even the government's own witnesses admitted, Sunrise owned the profits from those contracts. It was Sunrise's money. It wasn't the District of Columbia's money. If we lost money on operations, which we did, which Sunrise did it from year to year, that came out of Sunrise's pockets. A 501c3 has to have profits, has to have investment income, it has to have a reserve of money to keep going. And that's what this money was. In fact, again, since we're on this issue, there's never been any tracing that any of this money came from DCPS funding. There were, as we alleged in the petition, there were assets sold, real estate sold during this time frame. Sunrise had money from operations before the fraud scheme that was carried over to this period. There's been no tracing, and there was no proof ever anywhere that this money was specifically from DCPS contract payments.
I guess what I'm having, if you can just, I'll just tell you what the difficulty I see in this case,
yes.
And hopefully you can put me at rest. That is, there's a line. We can't use, this forfeiture proceeding cannot be used to contest the forfeitability of the property. And so the argument that, in fact, there was no crime if he was the alter ego of Sunrise and took from Sunrise seems to push on that prohibition against revisiting the forfeitability of these assets. If, on the other hand, the argument is a dispute, legal or factual, about alter ego status, that it's really whose money it was, then that seems to fall closer to the line of these proceedings where someone just shows a superior interest in the property. So please explain to me how you fall on the right line of that distinction.
Well, the Sunrise made a claim. First of all, Sunrise is the assignee of CoreVenture's interest in this case as well, and we submitted an ancillary petition as if we were CoreVenture's. Now, the district court itself found that the CoreVenture's could have challenged the forfeitability findings. That's number one, and we overlooked the fact that Sunrise actually had an assignment, an alleged assignment, which must be accepted as true. I think the law is better stated in the Reckmeyer case, which says, particularly in circumstances where a party did not have an opportunity to appear and be heard, that they have an opportunity to challenge. If they allege an ownership interest, they have standing to challenge the underlying forfeitability. And Sunrise has asserted multiple different forms of ownership in this money, as not only in its own right, but as through CoreVenture's. CoreVenture's, according to the district court, had the standing to challenge everything in this case, and they assigned their rights to the Sunrise. We've alleged that Sunrise owns CoreVenture's, and we believe that's true. We have documents showing that. But nonetheless, I think applying the due process-based standards of Reckmeyer, which I think this court really must apply, we have to have a hearing. Look at this in addition. You have a case, we're touching on this issue, where the district court found that Sunrise, without ever participating in a hearing, was a co-conspirator in a crime, without ever having any opportunity to submit evidence. Don't we at least get a hearing on that? It's very, very, very unfair. Now we have school operations ongoing now. We have teachers. Everyone's tarred with this finding that we're part of the criminal conspiracy when we had no opportunity to present evidence. Again, this was Mr. Emore who presented evidence in this case, not Sunrise. And we think it's very unfair to Sunrise to deny us any sort of a hearing at all on these issues.
Thank you. May it please the court, Zia Faruqi representing the appellee. Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
The district court correctly decided in this case to dismiss the appellant's petition without a hearing, as it failed to state facts that would have created a plausible claim for relief. Rather, as Your Honor identified, the petition sets forth largely legal conclusions that have no mooring to any facts related to this case. There are two independent failures that we can observe in terms of this failure to plead facts and rely upon legal conclusions.
Can I just ask one doctrinal question up front?
Absolutely.
Is it right to call this a dismissal for standing rather than failure to state a claim, even assuming it's a proper disposition after Lexmark?
I think, Your Honor, it is. Within forfeiture law, the precedent is very clear, going back to this court's opinion in BCCI, where there were general creditors that lacked an interest in the funds. The court held that they lacked standing, because if you don't have a legal interest in the funds, which is what is required for your case in controversy for Article III standing, as well as statutory standing.
But they assert a legal interest. The petition says, it does exactly what 853N3 says to do. It marches through it and says, here's our interest, our right title or interest, here's when we got it, and here's why it's ours. So why isn't that sufficient for meeting the pleading requirement of 853N?
I think it does meet the statutory standing requirement in terms of just checking those boxes of what has to be said. But the substance of those claims, while we assume the facts are true, this court has said in Browning v. Clinton, and as well applying Twombly as well as Iqbal, the facts there have to be facts that are plausible on its face. And so if there are facts that are not plausible or legal conclusions that are drawn, the court doesn't have to accept it. And that's, in fact, what Judge Friedman said. You don't get to fiat standing by just saying, I am an owner, therefore I have an ability to intervene in this proceeding. There must be some plausible facts that support that claim.
And when they say, here's the date, and I mean, if you just look at the petition, they march through. Why are those not just for purposes of, if you look at JA 288, right, here's Sunrise came into possession of this amount on this date. How else would you say you got something? I got it on this date.
Yes, sir. Those are facts that aren't relevant to the ownership at question as to Core Ventures and Sunrise. You know, they're going back to the beginning. There are certain facts that are pled there, but they're not relevant to the question of a recognized legal interest in these funds. Now, if the funds had never been transferred, then maybe those were facts that would be relevant to the beginning of the process. And if the funds, Charles E. Moore had never had access to those funds, that would certainly be the case.
See, then the difficulty with that approach is that you're applying sort of the district court's findings from the criminal case and the hearing of the preliminary order of forfeiture to a pleading disposition, as opposed to, I think 853N talks about applying those things at the hearing, but it doesn't talk about applying them at the pleading stage. So I'm trying to figure out why we get to import things from proceedings that they, by law, were not allowed to participate in to kick their petition out up front.
First, we're relying on the fact that the facts, Judge Freeman found their facts independently of his hearing. He stated that they don't present facts that supports the legal conclusions that they are drawing, which is that they're the owner of Core Ventures or that there was a secured loan that exists. Their basis for relief, which as a matter of law and forfeiture, are not enough to justify standing, but irrespective of that, there were no facts to support that. But then Judge Friedman went a step forward and said, I am allowed to look beyond the pleadings. He referenced D.C. District Court case, Sierra Club, as well as general 12B6 jurisprudence and 12B1 jurisprudence, as well as saying that he's not limited by the pleadings because subject matter is a jurisdictional question. So the court is bound as a truth finder to know whether or not they have jurisdiction. And so they are allowed to look beyond the pleadings directly in front of them.
No, but in what circumstance is a judge allowed in deciding standing to look to factual determinations made in a proceeding to which the pleading party was not a party and never had a chance to contest? And they say, you know, I want to contest that stuff.
Absolutely. Their opportunity to contest those findings and those statements, just factually, they didn't have to make any legal conclusions. They were required to plead facts in their petition, which was their opportunity to have a free pass. All those facts would have been assumed to be true, but they failed to allege a single fact that would have given them the right to then go forward and have a hearing and then meet their burden to have that proof. In BCCI, the court regularly held on multiple claims for petitions. It based its decision off of the preliminary order of findings from separate proceedings, saying that these are the alter ego, and that if they want to contest that they're alter ego, certainly they can. But they failed to do that in their pleadings. And so the court relied on...
Well, what if they thought the district court just got the alter ego test wrong as a matter of law, not fact?
Absolutely.
Why wouldn't this be sufficient? You don't need more facts. We'll take whatever facts you want. The law is wrong. Would they not have a right to a hearing on that?
They absolutely would. They just would have to allege it, which they did not allege in their petition or in their...
They said it's ours, not his. Why isn't that saying we dispute alter ego status?
I think that... Again, we rely on Twombly and Iqbal to say that these factual inferences aren't supported by the facts that they allege. So saying it's not that it's ours, not his, is a conclusion, and they have to allege just a fact. For instance, we had control over the funds, or for instance, we used the funds through a regulated process. Facts that we would have taken to be true, but still facts must be pled. We can't just rely on legal conclusions, or else everyone will just...
I don't think it's just legal conclusions when you look at their petition. I mean, they really do assert facts about when they came in, which are the facts that 853N tells them to assert.
They assert a beginning of those facts, which is that they got the funds. I mean, that's undisputed. But they don't assert facts that in forfeiture law, there are specific facts that must be pled to recognize legal interest. You must show facts towards that question, right? That's not the question.
So what else should they have alleged? If you look at JA 288 and 289, what else should have been added to those paragraphs?
I think that they should have... difficult because they are the alter ego, so I think that they are in the unenviable position that they can't allege those facts. But I think in general, the facts that a party...
What would an abstract person...
Yeah, so an abstract person would typically find in our 853 is that what a person says is that, this is my car, I have a title to it, or this is my car, I went and purchased it from a Honda down the street from me, and even though it's titled in my drug dealing mother's name or something like that, and I'm just an innocent owner, I'm a son, and I had no idea what my mother was doing. Or they say things like, for instance, this house, I lived in it 2 years ago. Even though there's no record of me, I have mail that I've gotten from Verizon with bills.
Sunrise owned all right and title to a BB&T bank account.
Absolutely.
And that's not sufficient?
No, that's not.
Because?
Because that's just a conclusion. What is the fact?
No, that's a factual assertion. I have the title to that bank. If I say I have a title to a bank account where I have a bank account, that's a factual assertion. I have that title.
Okay.
I think that's this is why I'm confused.
Sure.
In the briefing, because some of it seemed to characterize as legal things that seem factual to me.
I would certainly say that within ownership, there is a question of a legal and a factual component, and they do merge. So in the alternative, if there is discomfort in terms of, and I think that's reasonable to say that if someone says, I have title to that, that's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that goes to the pleading requirement of one cannot simply say that a fact is a fact and just leave it on that if it's not an inference that can be reasonably drawn from it. So just saying that they have title, I mean, when there's nothing that they propose to even say, for instance, like, we will present documents at a hearing that reference
but
the fact we opened
it. Do you have to say that in the petition?
I don't think they have to get in such detail, but in that example, yes. I mean, that's the only fact that they claim is that they say, we own this account, when in fact we know that Charles Emore opened the account. Charles Emore was the sole signatory of the account.
You know that only by importing facts from a proceeding that they weren't a party to.
Well, we know that. I mean, those facts are still the facts.
And that may be, and they may be fine, and they might, you know, maybe after a hearing, a court could reaffirm them. But 853N does not require them to disabuse the court of factual determinations made in another hearing. That's just not part of the pleading. I mean, the statute tells us what they have to plead. So that's why I'm having a little bit of difficulty.
But that, in terms of a statutory standing, is a pleading requirement. But in addition, case law recognizes that there's a constitutional requirement to show a recognized legal interest, and that Salty and other courts and White, they have found in the Eighth Circuit and Sixth Circuit, granted not this circuit, but even as well as this circuit's touching at BCCI, that it's not sufficient to just say a fact that has not that doesn't lead to a logical inference to say I have a legal interest in this.
Was all of the property forfeited nominally titled to Core Ventures?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it wasn't nominally titled to
Sunrise Academy.
To Sunrise Academy.
No, Your Honor. It was all in the name of Core Ventures.
So in order for Sunrise Academy to come in and say, to plead at least, we have a legitimate property interest when they are not Core Ventures, they would have to at least plead enough to show why they, as a different entity, should have a property interest in something that was forfeited from some other entity, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So isn't that the problem here?
Absolutely, yes. That's the problem, is they haven't done that. I think that's probably a much more efficient answer.
Why would they have to do that if, in fact, what Core Ventures had was taken from their account, and they are, in fact, the victim of the fraud?
Your Honor, in BCCI, as well as numerous other circuit court cases, this is the statutory scheme that Congress has created. Victims of fraud have no constitutional standing because they lack a specific interest in the funds that are issued, and therefore they are without standing to contest that. That's, in fact, why they try to draw upon this theory of a constructive trust, because it's a legal device to try to get around that, which this circuit does not adopt.
But what's curious about this is that if you find that they're the alter ego, right, no crime occurred, and if a crime occurred, then they are the victim, right?
Your Honor, I think that the elements of the crime are in fact met even if they are the alter ego, because beginning on a August 2nd emergency hearing a week before the plea of guilty, Judge Friedman was very clear, and trial counsel AUSA Lucas was very clear that the victim that the United States was going to show was the scheme or artifice to defraud was the D.C. government. That and that an alter ego theory was proffered before even the information was pled to or the defendant pled guilty. And the defendant pled guilty that after the judge very clearly said at that August 2nd hearing, this information leaves open that the scheme or artifice to defraud was the D.C. schools. And in the statement of facts, as well as the information. In paragraphs 6 and 7 and 8, it clearly states that this was a misuse of funds to benefit Charles E. Moore from the D.C. schools, and that that in and of itself meets the elements of wire fraud that this court has established.
I mean, it got very complicated because, you know, you were paying for services already rendered. It was an unusual situation, I guess, in that regard, and there was no dispute that students were taught and were graduating, or at least there weren't any findings because of the plea.
Yes, sir.
And I didn't read the plea to give this level of detail on these things. And so the money went from DCPS to Sunrise, and Sunrise was, it says, giving the education, and that there isn't a dispute that they were giving the education. And it's more, you may not have liked sort of how the money filtered through, and it's, you know, hard to figure out what Alexis has to do with education, but at the end of the day, the sort of, it's not like he was directly taking the money from DCPS and it went to Sunrise. And you weren't disputing that Sunrise was delivering the services that it was charging for. At least there was no finding.
That's right.
On that, and the court said that could be a close issue factually.
Charles E. Moore had the opportunity to decide what he did and did not want to plead to, and he decided to plead guilty and leave this complicated question of who the victim of his scheme or artifice to the fraud was. And he didn't appeal that decision that Judge Friedman quite clearly laid out in his 76-page finding and legal conclusion. And so I think that that is the law of the case, certainly.
Well, it can't be law of the case to them because they weren't a party to that proceeding.
No, it's a law of the case to the fact that a fraud occurred and who the fraud victim was. They don't have an opportunity as the court noted, they don't have an opportunity in the ancillary hearing to relitigate what the scope of the fraud was or whether or not
it wasn't until the preliminary order of forfeiture that there was any effort, not the criminal case, but the actual preliminary order of forfeiture where they first identified who the victim might be. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. I mean, that was in response to the plea was to the elements of the crime, and then the judge issued his opinion in response to that, which certainly touched upon forfeiture, but there was a separate issue as to loss calculation and restitution, which is all part and parcel of the court's Rule 11 colloquy in terms of what the fact-finding of guilt was and what the scope of the fraud was in determining a sentence based on that. Mm-hmm. So in the final order of forfeiture, which came later, the judge called it final and then corrected himself, said it was that original was a preliminary. Certainly it touched upon those issues, but that original 76-page opinion, that is related to the Rule 11 colloquy. It certainly touches because forfeiture is a part of sentencing on forfeiture, but that is certainly not an issue that's open for litigation or, you know, in front of this court.
Forfeitability clearly is not, but the interest and whether they in fact, whether it was their money that he
Absolutely.
Then pilfered, I take it as what they want to contest now that they have the first chance to do so.
They absolutely can contest that they're the owner of those funds, but as to whether or not the victim of the funds, right, that's a question that is not open for litigation. We don't allow victims to come in through forfeiture to say, I should have gotten restitution, I was the victim of this. I mean, there's
no, we're using victim in the sense here just to say whether they were an alter ego or whether, in fact, it was their account.
Exactly. I think that their argument is they can't be both, so.
But we would certainly say they're not the victim, Your Honor. And I think that the record created by the judge at that August 2nd hearing, at the August 9th plea, during when the plea was taken, the plea documents, and then the judge's opinion make clear that the government from the beginning said that Sunrise Academy, prior to the plea of guilty, was the alter ego, and that the court still found the elements of wire fraud, as this court set forward.
I understand what the government said, but I guess the difficulty I'm having with this is what did they prove? Because the plea here doesn't really go to that, and there's nothing here that shows any way in which the government has traced the money from the district to this fraud, and so that seems problematic here.
But, Your Honor, that wasn't contested, so the government's not under a burden now to go back and prove what it was supposed to. You know, it made that proof in the original hearing, but that's an argument for Charles E. Moore to make about tracing, the tracing of funds for forfeitability. That's very much a question.
Why isn't an argument for them? As I read it, the allegation here is that E. Moore took money from Sunrise bank accounts.
Absolutely.
Sunrise bank accounts is where the money was taken from. He didn't take it directly from DCPS, and so they want to say, he took it from us.
Mm-hmm.
And if he took it from us, then he should not have taken it from us. And that was a bad thing to do. But you don't want to give them any opportunity to do that. You want to say he was taking it from them for purposes of showing a filter-through fraud from DCPS, but then as soon as they go, well, if he took it from us, you know, and we are one and the same entity with him, he couldn't have taken anything that wasn't his. And so you're trying to have your cake and eat it, too. Or just help us understand how you're not trying to have your cake and eat it, too.
I'm definitely not trying to have my cake and eat it, too. What I'll say is just there is a fine point there, but there's one to be made. The question of tracing in terms of whether or not that goes to their ownership claim, that's certainly something that would be open to litigation had that they pled such sufficient facts that Judge Friedman thought that that was an issue that could be questions raised. All I was answering, and I'm trying to limit my answer to what, Judge Brown, I thought you were asking, which is in terms of the original finding, did the government at the beginning meet its elements to prove a wire fraud existed because it didn't trace funds that went from D.C. public schools to Sunrise Academy that were then misused? Is that it didn't need to do that to meet its elements for wire fraud for a conviction of Charles Emore. And in fact, Charles Emore pled guilty knowing that that was the government's proof, and he admitted it. So that issue wasn't contested in terms of the original trial.
Well, you know, this is just really, it's troubling because Charles Emore is not contesting this because he's getting a really good deal, right? The plea is to his benefit. So he has no reason, you know, to try to hold the government to its proof. But the result of that, if you find that there is no distance between Sunrise and Charles Emore, is that they aren't able to make any argument about whether who's entitled to this money.
No, they certainly are, Your Honor, because all they have to allege in their petition, which is all they had to do, is put one fact forward to say we had an independent board or that we were not the alter ego because we had internal controls. There are no such facts that are alleged in their petition. So the petition is their opportunity to have their voice in court heard. And if their petition, which is a low threshold, but one which courts have regularly held, when people don't meet that low threshold, they don't then get to automatically go into court. So they would have absolutely had their opportunity had they even alleged facts. But the problem is a factual, those facts don't exist. And that's why they couldn't.
Right, but just to be clear, so you're saying the thing that they had to allege was not just what 853N says to allege, but then they also had to separately allege at least one fact that would have pulled the rug out from under the alter ego determination, such as control over the board.
I think that they would have to plead. Yes, Your Honor. They would have to plead something that shows a recognized legal interest. That 853.
And the only reason what they said it didn't count as a recognized legal interest is because of the separate alter ego determination.
Judge Friedman, in fact, relied upon what point by point by all of their claims.
No, but you just said they had to allege some control over the board.
It's not as if there's magic fact, one magic fact or silver bullet. They needed any fact. That is one example of a fact they could have alleged.
What fact did they need to allege that has nothing to do with alter ego status?
They could have alleged that there was a secured interest that they had in the funds, which they failed to do. Judge Friedman stated that they just tried to create new law and have no support of it, saying that as the owner, that they have a secured interest.
We're trying to create new law isn't failure to plead standing problem. It might be a 12b6 problem, but it's not a lack of standing problem.
But as the court said,
they were a secured creditor.
Sure, but I think that goes back to the original point. The court does have some sort of, there's a prejudice to the district court to have, if they're in the situation where claimants can just merely state without any sort of basis to their facts, right, which are the basic pleading requirements, and just say, I am the owner, and get to come in and say, I am the owner, therefore I get to have a hearing. I mean, the rule was created in Congress in the notes to the comments, adopted and noted with positive reference to the BCCI cases, that the court has large discretion that they think that there's not a claim that can go forward because the person's in a legal interest, that it should be dismissed without a hearing.
They said, we have a bank account that Charles Emore took money from. And the centerpiece of the government's prosecution is that it was a Sunrise bank account owned by Sunrise that this money was taken out of. Why is that asserting a legal interest?
Because that means they're the victim of a fraud.
Saying victim. They're saying I have a legal interest, and in fact the record of your criminal proceeding doesn't dispute that we had title to that bank account and the money in it.
But forfeiture did not come from funds from a Sunrise bank account. It came from a Core Ventures bank account, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. They concede that.
The whole point was that it started in a Sunrise account. Did DCPS pay it to a Core account or a Sunrise account?
They paid it to Sunrise account.
They paid it to Sunrise account. And the problem was he then took that money from Sunrise's account and put it in
Sunrise,
the car account.
Sunrise sanctioned and sent the money over
that's
to...
That's the question they want to dispute.
Well, but they don't dispute
but
it.
The factual thing that came out of CORE was that's looking too far down the line because nothing went from DCPS to CORE. Am I right on that?
Nothing went from DCPS to CORE.
Okay. And so the only way it could have gotten to Charles E. Moore was to have been taken out of a Sunrise account.
Certainly, Your Honor, but I mean the nature of the forfeiture case law is very clear that separate transactions, once that occur, the funds have moved from one party to another. The first party, at best, is just a victim of fraud, which is not enough for standing, or that they're a victim and that their funds were taken. They lack standing then. That's just the way that the law is written,
so
and there's a protection for them.
Money's, just assume away the alter ego finding. You lose mm-hmm. title when your money is stolen by, say, CORE or Charles E. Moore?
I think that would then, if they allege that the money was stolen, there was no alter ego, no, that they would have, and they pled some fact to say, the funds were stolen from us, you know, if, for instance, the funds were taken without our permission, mm-hmm. then yes, that would be enough to create standing, but that's not something that they have here. Huh. There are no further questions. I would ask that the court affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
All right. I know that Mr. Quinn has no time left, but we'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Oh, thank you very much, Your Honor, because I just heard counsel acknowledge that if Sunrise had alleged that Mr. E. Moore had stolen the money from it, that we would have stated a claim. And that's exactly what we alleged. It's right in our petition. We alleged that the money was embezzled.
Now, tell me what page of your petition you're referring to, please.
I don't have the page with me, right, Your Honor, but I know we alleged that this was the proceeds of embezzlement. Mm-hmm. And that's an argument we made here.
Are you referring to, I think, JA 289? According to the district court's March 23 memorandum opinion, Mr. Imore's embezzlement
yes.
from Sunrise occurred at the time of each transfer?
Yes. That was a finding by the district court. If it was embezzlement is very different than fraud because right. when an embezzlement occurs under District of Columbia law, ownership isn't transferred. It's like stealing someone's car. It's a theft.
But that was only for the constructive trust argument, and this court has held that the constructive trusts aren't going to count for forfeiture.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor, but our argument, and I think it's correct, is that there's no need for a constructive trust when there's a theft or an embezzlement because ownership doesn't transfer as a matter of law. In other words, the thief doesn't get title to property that he steals, nor does the embezzler. And we allege that, and there was not just a little, but a lot of evidence to that in this case. Just for example, the indictment alleged three times that it was embezzlement, 54, 57, and 64. Mr. E. Moore pled guilty to obtaining money from Sunrise for his own benefit, 205. The district court found it consists of a scheme of theft. 220. The district court found that Mr. E. Moore controlled Sunrise's bank accounts and finances, 244. Now, when a corporate officer with control of a bank account takes money for himself, as the plea itself found, that's embezzlement. That's not.
But you didn't plead any facts, specific facts in your petition that of how any embezzlement took place that specifically contradicted sworn testimony that the court had just heard under oath that all of these things had been done kind of following by authorized people from Sunrise, right?
Your Honor, first of all, I think we did, but I don't believe that's the pleading standard.
Well, what did you plead?
We pled that each one of these transfers, each time this money was taken out, it came directly out of Sunrise's accounts. And we allege that those transfers were embezzlement. What more than that do we need to allege that it was embezzlement?
Well, embezzlement's a legal conclusion. What fact did you allege to show that it was embezzlement rather than an authorized transfer from the board? Did you ever dispute that the board authorized every one of these transfers?
I don't know. We didn't, Your Honor, and I really don't think.
Can you have embezzlement? Go ahead.
I think that's taking notice pleading to a level that.
Well, as a matter of law, can you have embezzlement if the board has authorized the transfers?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
I believe you can, and certainly you know, in this case, it was a whole scheme of embezzlement. The whole, the general scheme that Mr. Emore was indicted for was using the company credit card, paying personal expenses from the company's account. And the district court itself found this was theft, and the indictment said embezzlement. You know, what more do we need? I mean, it's certainly we have a right to a hearing on this claim. If it's embezzlement, we win. We also respectfully, on the BCCI case, we think that case is distinguishable. But another thing I'd like to point out on this issue of
pleading. I'm sorry, quickly, how do you distinguish BCCI?
Yes, in my limited time, but I do think it's distinguishable because in the BCCI was a case where Judge Silberman declined to impose a constructive trust, requested that the parties requested that the court apply in this case, in the BCCI case. We don't know where these were international transactions. I don't know why that request, but that was made, but it was apparently made. In this case, a constructive trust exists. It exists now. We never asked the court to impose one. It exists as a matter of law in the District of Columbia. This case arises under District of Columbia law, and the court's bound to apply it. So applying District of Columbia law, there is a constructive trust. We cited the cases that say that it arises immediately upon the transfer, and that's exactly the same issue that happened in the Ninth Circuit case. I think it was Wilson. But it's the exact same case. In every circuit, by the way, counsel said that most circuits don't allow a constructive trust theory. This circuit is the only one that doesn't allow didn't allow a constructive trust theory, and we suggest that it should be limited to the facts, which were a case where the parties were asking for a court-imposed constructive trust. It couldn't be retroactive.
Do you need a constructive trust to have a sufficient pleading here?
No, not for embezzlement. I don't believe we do because there's no transfer of ownership. And I'd like to also make the point that the alter ego finding, I don't believe there's any pleading obligation that you're not an alter ego. The case that's being relied on here is one of the BCCI cases. And that was a case where a subsidiary of BCCI in the forfeiture proceeding was found to be, the property was forfeited because that subsidiary was an alter ego, and the court said you should have alleged that. In this case, there was no such finding in the forfeiture proceeding at all. This came in a separate proceeding, the MVRA findings. This was not part of forfeiture, and again, it was contrary to the law of the case.
Why should it matter which portion of the court's reasoning, MVRA or forfeiture, the alter ego determination occurred in? Why should it matter?
Well, it's
all one big long opinion.
It's really not because the grounds for forfeiture had nothing to do with Sunrise being an alter ego. The grounds for forfeiture was that it was proceeds of fraud. So that was the BCCI case that they're relying on. That was when the alter ego theory was the grounds for forfeiture. You know, again, this is notice pleading, I don't think a party is bound to plead that they're not an alter ego, particularly, again, in this case, where the law of the case is that they were defrauded. If they were defrauded, they could not have been an alter ego as a matter of law.
Thank you, Mr. Quinn.
Thank you very much.
Case will be submitted.